So there's an interesting quirk in our calendar that it's very unusual for a Heskamina rabbi to be available and present for Tisha B'Av, but I will be back for Tisha B'Av, and for the first time in years, I'll be reading from the book of Eicha, which I will admit will necessitate some preparation because it's been quite a while, but I'm excited. It's a beautiful melody and a lovely service. So what does Tisha B'Av, the ninth of Av, remember? What are some of the things that we recall on Tisha B'Av? Many things. Among them, destruction of a temple, both temples. Expulsion in 1492 is one of the things ascribed to be executed on Tisha B'Av.
The community complained a whole lot. God said, you're going to complain? I'll give you something to complain about.
That's in this week's parasha. The ultimate denial of the elder generation that they would ever enter the land. So in that section where the scouts, we often call them spies, I think they were more accurately scouts, sent to reconnoiter the land. Although I guess the difference between spies and scouts is really what side you're on, I suppose. A spy to one side is a scout to the other. So they voice their complaints, they demonstrate a lack of faithfulness in God's power to deliver them and to deliver the land to the Israelite people. It is a magical, enormous land, a land of greatness and goodness, and they seem quite distressed by their capacity, or something of a Cassandra in their capacity to overtake the people of the land. Except for, of course, Hoshea, as he was called up to this point. And this is one of the parshiot where we see a name change, that one of the rewards for his faithfulness in God's power, in God's providence, is that he is turned from Hoshea to Yoshua. More or less the same name, very similar in name. Maybe it indicates a different aspect of the verb, that it was, that one was saved, that one was rescued, to that one will be rescued. But it's not so clear, the etymological difference, but the difference in orthographics in writing is just a yud, just a single small letter, which prompts a really lovely midrash. So there are occasional midrashim where the letters of the Hebrew alphabet are personified. There's a famous one about Aleph and which letter would start Aleph and Bet and which letter would start the Torah. So there's also one in this week's parasha about the yud. So centuries before, the Yud had been removed from Sarai's name. Remember Sarah, our matriarch? Her original name was Sarai, and it's a very similar name to Sarah. It's a more or less a Yud substituted for a Hay. And it was flying before the divine throne all the years, crying out before God, because I'm the smallest of letters, I was taken out of Sarah's name and removed from the Torah, until this week's parasha when it was added to Joshua's name. That's sweet and simple and acute midrash, but it's later expanded upon, or it's not clear which came first, but there's also another beautiful midrash in the Talmud itself that expands on this story, or that uses this story in a secondary telling. So David, our king, later king, pleads before God, sovereign of the universe, who understands one's own errors? And God says, well, I would certainly forgive you. These are elements of the high holiday liturgy. And God says, maybe you could scratch my sin, my transgression with Bathsheba out of the Torah, out of the scripture. Let me just remove the story. Let's edit that one out. You know, I think it was in the 14th century that Bodler edited out all the naughty parts of Bible. It was 19th, I thought it didn't sound right, 19th century. So the Bible was much shorter, I'm sure. And you get the idea of Bodlerizing something, of removing the naughty parts. So that's sort of what David wants. He says, you know, maybe you could remove this mistake I made. And God says, that's not possible, because there was once I removed the single letter Yud from Sarah's name, and that Yud made such a fuss for centuries. You think I could pull whole paragraphs and chapters out of the Torah? It would never fly. So we have to keep the Torah, the scripture, Bible, Tanakh, as it is. Which suggests to me, and David is a great paradigm for this, and Yeshua, all the scouts, that our past is our past. You don't get to change your past. That people who would deny their history, or who would live in denial, or who would try to misremember the past, do a great disservice to their present. And as they say, if you fail to learn from history, you will be doomed to repeat it. that our transgressions of our past, our own personal stories, our own national narratives, are there sometimes as cautionary tales. And sometimes they're just the things we needed to learn when we were 13 or 26 so that we could become the people we are now. And the problem is not so much that we would dwell upon them and fixate upon them, but we can't forget them either. And we can't change the past. We can't pretend we weren't more vain, more hypocritical, more arrogant, different to the way we are now. We can't pretend. One of the true insights of 12-step programs of recovery from gambling or other addictions is to acknowledge one's past mistakes and to seek not to repeat them and to apologize when one makes future mistakes. Bernard and I had a funny little conversation. He was assigning honors. It's been a little while since he sat on the Bema as president, which was a wonderful tenure. And he said, well, if I forgot anything, I guess I forgot something. And I said, you know, all you can do now is apologize. That's David's lesson of the past, that the past is past. Doesn't mean we erase it, doesn't mean we forget it, but we learn from it and move forward and we don't dwell there. Nonetheless, the present has its own challenges, and we see them in this week's parasha as well. The great images of Israelite faithlessness come in the Torah readings that we did not read in this triennial cycle, but come in the spies' reports of the land. And they're sent to discover, you know, is it a hardy land? Is it an arable land? How is the produce there? Are the towns fortified? Are the people strong or weak? And they have interesting comments about the land, some of which are very indicative of this particular sacred space. They say that it is a land, ohelet yoshveha, that eats its inhabitants. And thereby, there dwell people of renown, people of great stature, people of great midot, attributes. We saw giants there and the descendants of giants, and to ourselves we appeared as grasshoppers. And thereby to them, they saw us as grasshoppers as well. The classic story being that however you understand your insecurities, eventually everyone else will see them too. And that you can't pretend to be something you're not, or hiding who you are, hiding your insecurities and your own discomforts is a vain enterprise. It never really works. People generally will see you eventually as you are. But what's very interesting, sort of a very modern view of the language of this little section, these two verses, is that Rabbi Yitzhak Avorka, one of the middle era of the Hasidic rabbis, someone who always speaks in lovely aphorisms, notes that Eretz Ochelet Yoshveha, the land that devours or eats its inhabitants, Yoshveha is those who settle in a place, those who dwell in that place, those who sit literally in a place. He reads that settling in a very modern way, as if we might describe, you know, settling on a date or settling on a relationship or settling in a job. He says, people who are complacent. This is a land that will not tolerate complacency. A very sort of modern understanding of what it means to settle. I don't think that's the classic Hebrew understanding of it, but sometime in the 19th century, he used it the way we would today. So in the past, we have to let go of our mistakes or learn from them, or learn and then move forward. And in the present, we don't sit still. We don't dwell in one place for very long. As Mindy pointed out, we are not a people of towers and palaces, but a people of movement and energy. And Shabbat is our time of rest, but the other 6 days a week, we're enjoined to work. And frankly, in many sources, Musar of the 19th century and elsewhere, enjoined to work on ourselves. That a community, a person, a job, a creation is never complete, is always undergoing transformation and embedded in a system of growth. The land would eat us if we were complacent. Life is short, not a lot of time to be complacent. As various sources say, there's time for rest when you're dead. So that's past and present. What about our futures? Our future together, our future as individuals, and our futures with each other, the growth of future relationships. So here we have in the very closure of our parasha two really wonderful images. the gatherer of wood and the tzitzit that give us touchstones or mile markers for our future. So we're told that on one of the first Shabbatot, there was someone who went outside the camp to gather wood. And that was one of the first visible violations of the Shabbat, and that person was stoned to death. So who was that person? Well, Midrash has a very interesting tendency. They try to fill in the blank names with names from other sections, logically, who would be connected to the story. So one of the places that our Midrash fills in this name, the Mikoshesh Etzim, the gatherer of wood, it notices that not long thereafter, still in the book of Numbers, about 15 chapters later, the daughters of Tzlofechad come asking and say, our father was one of the ones who died in the wilderness. Could you clarify our inheritance policy? So Rabbi Akiva notes, well, he must have been the gatherer of wood, which is an interesting logical assessment. You know, they're somewhat proximate to each other. It's a fair thing to say. And immediately Rabbi Yehuda ben Batera assaults him. And I think his assault is perfect, and a perfect example of moral rebuke. He says, Akiva, whether you are right or wrong, that's my words, whether you are right or wrong, he says, in either case you will be called to task. Because if you're right and that fellow was Tzlofechad, the Torah hid his name, and you revealed his name. And if you're wrong, you're casting a stigma on someone who is already righteous. I think one of the messages there about our past and our present, whether we are complacent or not, is you don't poke fun at people. It doesn't do much good to point out to your friend his or her flaws. As said in another tradition, we all know our own flaws. It's not lost on me or on many people what they've done wrong in their life. In fact, if you're lucky, if you can sleep through the night without thinking of too many of those things. So don't point it out to your friends. Let them have the opportunity for growth and shield them from the scorn of reminding them of something they might have done in the past or something they might have gotten away with, God forbid. That's one way to live for the future. That's one way to allow each other, to allow ourselves to grow. And the other is this, these. As I pointed out in the teaching I did right before we began Birchat HaShachar, tzitzit are witnesses for us. They're reminders of mitzvot, and they're reminders to stay on the licit paths of behavior. And the crimson cord that Joshua has as a sign with the rachav is another way to do that. Little reminders, little lures, little attractions, little things we look at day to day that keep us on the right path. You know, this used to be our clothing. This is picture of Greeks and Romans in their toga. You know, it wasn't just a thing that fraternities do for parties. This used to be clothes. And our clothing was similar, as I understand, but instead of a long sheet that we'd sleep in and then cover ourselves with as we walked about on the street, we added these fringes, both to indicate that we were a different people than the Hellenized world we may have lived in or the pre-Hellenic world we lived in, but also as simple as tying a knot on your finger as reminders that God is around us and about us and the mitzvot are everywhere. And says the Talmud, looking upon them leads to remembering the commandments. Looking upon this commandment leads to remembering all commandments. And remembering leads to doing them. That our past, our present, our future are not really distinct things, but they're all part of one continuum. And the trick is to be able to be constantly moving, not moving away from and hiding from and running from, but growing constantly, learning from the mistakes of one's past, never sitting still and being complacent, and never punishing oneself for the growth one has not yet achieved. As Rabbi Sachs said in a recent one of his Divrei Torah that's sent out, failure is just a success you haven't achieved yet.